Joining me tonight. I hope you're having a great summer and you're paying attention to what's happening in the news. I think we're all being called to be aware, to know the issues, to stand up, to understand who has our backs and know who doesn't give a care about women in the middle class. So with those thoughts in mind, as well as the topics of our show tonight, I open the show with a cut by Lisa Thiel, a local L.A. artist called Warrior Goddess, an archetype we must seriously consider embodying with only about 100 days until the election. You know, we could seriously end up with a puppet president for the millionaires and billionaires in the White House who doesn't invest his money in America, who doesn't care about women's rights, who cares solely for the 1%. Mitt Romney's constituency is not you and me. I hope you're telling your friends they must plan to get out and vote, especially with all the voter suppression Republicans are trying to pull to thwart democracy and deny people more likely to vote for Obama the right to vote. It's truly despicable. There is a difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. It's just insane. We're still battling to keep contraceptives and our reproductive rights. It's insane. We have a party blatantly trying to steal the election because they have no good ideas or care about the majority of the American people. It's insane. We have to constantly fight the Republicans to keep our air and water clean, to have decent working conditions, to enjoy our constitutional rights. Well, if you're new to the show, I'm your hostess, Karen Tate, and I'm the author of two acclaimed books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and its bookend, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. Both teach you to lead a goddess-inspired life, whether you're learning about goddess around the world, traveling to her sacred sites, or you just want to know why the sacred feminine is still relevant today and how you can invite her in. Tonight I have a great show planned for you, I think. First up is Joan Marler. She's a writer, editor, and scholar who worked closely with Maria Gimbutas for 7 years. She's the founder and executive director of the Institute for Archaeomythology and will be celebrating the Gorgon Medusa tonight in our discussion. Then we're going to put our activist caps on because we have with us the controversial Lear Keith, author of The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability, and Deep Green Resistance, Strategy to Save the Planet. She's going to tell us how bad it is and what we need to do to get organized and offer resistance to save ourselves and the planet. She's truly a warrior goddess. But a few quick housekeeping tips first. I want to invite you to check out my website, KarenTate.com, and learn more about my books, classes, Sacred Sunday services held every fourth Sunday in North Hollywood. Don't miss the free meditations while you're there. They're my gift to you, my listeners. And remember, please, Blog Talk is not free to hosts, and contributions are welcome. Listeners might not realize that hosts pay out of our pockets to give their guests a platform to teach and share their wisdom. And this week, we got a generous donation from Molly. So thanks, Molly, for your kind words of support and for your donation. It is certainly appreciated. There are PayPal buttons on my Goddess store page if you'd like to make a credit card contribution. Any amount, no matter how small, is a help because, you know, it all adds up. And I'm very open to a regular, like-minded sponsor. Maybe your group or company would like to sponsor the show for a month or two or three. Maybe you have an event coming up you'd like to advertise because I do some commercials. Contact me if you're interested in chatting about the possibilities. And time is running out, so I'm reminding you again, the Aphrodite, Demeter, and Persephone artifacts that are on loan at the Getty Museum in Malibu will not be there too much longer. I can't think of a better place to spend a Sunday at a temple of goddess overlooking her marvelous Pacific Ocean. The views there, the gardens, the fountains, the settings are just unsurpassed. Finally, an anthology I contributed to is out. It's called Jesus Through Pagan Eyes by Mark Townsend. I contributed a chapter called A Goddess Advocate Talks About Jesus. It might be of interest to those of you transitioning away from the Abrahamic religions and embracing goddess. Remember, catch any show from the archives. You can listen via iTunes. You can call in and chat with me or my guests at 718-766-4662. And when I get to a natural stopping point in the conversation, I'll take your calls. So without further delay, let me welcome Joan and thank her for waiting so patiently through my intro. Welcome, Joan.
Well, thank you, Karen. It's a pleasure to be here, and it was great to listen to your intro, and I very much appreciate the way that you are combining activism with spirituality, particularly goddess spirituality. It's so important to be engaged and to know that it really does matter. Everything we think and everything we conjure within ourselves and everything we do in the world.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that, Joan. You know, when I get political, I always hope I'm not making my guests uncomfortable. But like you said, I too believe it is so vitally important because, you know, as I go out there and I teach, I realize that so many people really are not connecting the dots between maybe their goddess studies and politics. You know, that's why I've actually started teaching classes on it. I'll leave it at that. You know, some just aren't connecting the dots. So I'm hoping, you know, they realize, you know, that if, you know, that goddess ideals are particular ideals and they can reconcile their spirituality and their politics.
Yes, well, of course it can be extremely overwhelming what's going on in the world. It is overwhelming. It's horrific. And especially the further we look, the more we see that things are out of balance and the very life on Earth is being threatened. So where do you even begin?
Yeah.
But we begin with ourselves. We begin with connecting with ourselves and with what we value most and then go from there.
Well, and I would recommend to any listeners who are trying to maybe carve out some time to learn about the issues, because it is hard to keep up with everything. People are struggling just to make ends meet. People are struggling to keep jobs, find jobs, put food on the table, pay the rent, pay the mortgage. You know, I would say if you listen to nobody else, tune in to Rachel Maddow on MSNBC.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
You know, she's great. You know, she's a smart woman. I think she's a Rhodes Scholar. She's interested in women's issues. She's interested in equality and justice and fairness, which I believe are all goddess ideals. So,
absolutely.
You know, tune in nowhere else. You know, that's the only hour you have. Give it to Rachel Maddow.
And she's an example of our warrior goddess operating today. So.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. And you too, Joan. How often you have to go to bat and you know, make people understand what Maria Gimbutas was about. You know, and tonight, you know, we're talking about the, you know, Medusa. I think some might not realize, and tell me if I'm wrong, but Medusa, the Gorgon, I mean, she's an archetype that women might need to embrace in these times, is she not?
Oh, absolutely. And she has really played a really major role in Western civilization. I mean, she is a figure that is put up to be decapitated again and again and again. And we might ask, why? You know, I mean, the figure of Perseus decapitating Medusa was right in the center of Florence, in the Piazza Vecchio, until it was taken away, for, you know, to put in the museum. But it's like a central iconic image of the hero slaying this potent female form.
Well, is it going too far to say it's the patriarchy, you know, taking over from you know, mother right or the matriarchy? Is that a little bit too extreme, or could that be accurate as well?
I think that it is a takeover. It's what Joseph Campbell called the Great Reversal.
Okay.
I mean, it's a wonderful term, the Great Reversal. yeah. from, and the way what he meant was the tremendous change between the idea of the concept of the sacred source being at the center of all that lives. I mean, you get out, you know, we have this wonderful image of the Earth from outer space. What a revelation. And there she is. There is this living body there, giving birth to itself, this teeming life and returning to itself in death in this vast cyclic symphony of life, death, and regeneration. And there you have it right there. And that, so the idea that that woman as an expression of that sacred source, who is the birth giver, who is the death wielder, who is the regenerix, as Maria would describe it, is a completely different concept of creator when you have the Father God outside who is creating the world out of something that is not of his substance. And, of course, you might ask, well, what is he creating it out of? You know, it's really her. And then becoming the creator god, and that's replicated, of course, in the then Tiamat being killed by Marduk. I mean, it's in the myths,
right.
that takeover, that great reversal.
Well, and I know you're going to talk about how Medusa is associated with other goddesses like Artemis, Hecate, and Athena, but let me just interject right here. I want to know if I understand it correctly. What you were just talking about, how the great reversal. Don't we see the very same thing when Athena is birthed from Zeus's head, her mother is practically out of the equation?
Absolutely. In fact, that story of the birth of Athena encapsulates so much about what this great reversal is. And many people may not know the story, but, you know, Zeus is Indo-European, basically, for God, the sky god, the generic sky god. And there he is taking a very prominent form in the consciousness of the Greeks. And what does he do? I mean, he's out raping the goddesses and women. And why are they running from him? They're running. They're shape-shifting. They're trying to get away. I mean, if he's the great god, I mean, why wouldn't you want to lay down with the god? Well, no, it's because his whole attitude is raping. And this is called marrying. It's not really marrying. And so one of the goddesses that he pursued and eventually caught and raped was Metis. And Metis is the intelligence of life, the intelligence of the earth. I mean, she's that one that's that spark of that green flame of everything that lives. And he raped her and then forgot about her and went off to run around after somebody else. And after a while, he got this message to say, we just want to let you know that this Metis, remember Metis? I mean, she's pregnant now, and she's pregnant with somebody who's more powerful than you. It's like, what? So Zeus goes and finds her, and through his magic, he gets her and reduces her to the size of a fly and swallows her. Okay, so then you have the swallowing of the intelligence, that central intelligence of the earth, of life. And it starts to work in his system, but it gives him a splitting headache. It disagrees with his system.
Mm-hmm.
Because this system is all about domination. And at a certain point, he's so racked with pain that he calls his smithy, Hephaestus, who comes in with a double axe. I mean, this is shown iconographically on, you know, so nicely illustrated for us on Greek faces and so on, to crack his head open and get this thing out. He cracks his head open, and out comes Athena with a battle cry, fully armed. And she basically declares that she has no mother, and that she is the daughter of the father, or she is in his service. Well, I mean, the matrilineage has been broken, has been swallowed. And so it's really then the story of Athena, who was actually much more ancient than the Greeks, much more ancient than the Indo-European influence, and she's pre-Indo-European. She's pre-Greek. She's part of the indigenous old European deities of the Balkan Peninsula, and she's Indo-Europeanized.
So because really Athena would never have, in her authentic essence, would never have let herself be co-opted that way. This is purely patriarchy at work spinning
yes.
the story.
Yes, of course. And taking over all that she represents. I mean, she brings with her this incredible lineage of all the arts of civilization. You know, weaving and all of the crafts and all of the, I mean, just this incredible cultural richness that she represents. And now they're his, you know.
Right.
Now they're, you know, they're for the polis. They're for, you know, they're for this project, this patriarchal project. But then you have Medusa. You have the Gorgons, and how do they fit into it? And it's a very fascinating tale, how they fit together.
Well, tell us, please.
Okay.
Because I think most of us, you know, we don't really know the feminist theology of the myth. You know, we've come up with this idea that Medusa is evil. You know, she must be slain. I mean, after all, you know, she'll cause people, you know, to turn to stone if she gazes upon them. You know, she's got snakes for hair that can, I guess, bite you and kill you. But what was patriarchy really doing? You know, let's, you know, kind of, you know, go beneath the sands and see what their twisted logic has done to the real Medusa.
Right. Well, of course, it's a justification for destruction. And, you know, this kind of thing, justification of any kind of abuse, justification of rape, justification of the Inquisition, the, you know, anything you can look at that is part of this patriarchal project that leads to the destruction of the full radiant powers that women bring with them is part of that whole, that same story. But just to get back to Medusa, first of all, Medusa is one of the three Gorgon sisters. And the three Gorgon sisters are part of the whole lineage of triple goddesses that are found in many places of the world, not just in Greece. And what is this triplicity? You know, past, present, and future. Birth, death, regeneration, the different phases of the woman's life, the, you know, the phases of the moon and the tides and all this great movement that is part of the life coming forth from her and returning and then being regenerated again. So in that cyclic nature, that lunar nature, the lunar and solar nature that's intertwined here, you have not just the birth-giving aspect, but you also have the necessary coming into fruition and then the return. And that return is an essential part of the whole cycle, because without the coming apart of the forms, the composting of what had been in living form to release the nutrients that are there to reconfigure into a new life form, all life on Earth would be finished. So it has to be that whole cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So the Gorgons represent that whole cycle.
So saying in a way this is our denial of death?
It is a denial of death. I think that the old European sensibility embraces it. And many indigenous people throughout the world understand that you can't just have this birth, 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 grow, 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 grow. There has to be the return. And then the big question that, or one of the big questions that determines the kind of fundamental nature of any society and any individual is, how do we face that? What is our relationship to that inevitability? And Maria Gimbutas wrote a lot about that, because in looking at the old European iconography, the old European symbolism. I mean, she saw that that aspect of the death regeneration was incredibly important. And now, in getting back to the Gorgon, and there's so much here to untangle, you know, and I hope everybody's able to follow me here. Let's look at one aspect of the triplicity of the Gorgon, past, present, and future. The past and the future are eternal. The only aspect that exists in the field of present time is Medusa. She represents that moment of present time. And actually, this moment can never be captured. It has no dimensions. It is this kind of this fountain of emerging, this fountain of becoming, that as soon as it appears, it's already passed. So there really is no catching of it. And that's why Medusa could be the only one who could be killed, but she's never killed, because in that act of killing, it's already in the past.
Ah.
And she's actually eternal.
And just to clarify, her two sisters are the past and the future, right? She's
her
the
past
present.
And the future,
okay.
And they have names. All of the figures from Greek mythology have names, and they have histories, and they have stories, and lots of layers of stories, and sometimes the stories go together, sometimes they contradict, and there's a kind of a palimpsest of various stories. But in general, there's Euryale, who is the great primordial sea, the ocean from which all life comes, right? And then there is Threno, which is strength. You know, that strength that's at the center of the life force. And then you have Medusa, this wisdom of the presence of the moment, this moment now. And, of course, there's stories that their parents were basically deities of the sea. Her father is Porcus, who is related to Hades in the underworld, and so on and so forth, many, many layers of things. But they come from, their genealogy is a recognition of the primordial powers that are encoded in that triplicity.
Okay.
So Medusa then carries that lineage, and Athena is part of that lineage too. In fact, it's important to realize that all of these goddesses within the Greek pantheon are interrelated. They really are not just distinct. It's easy to atomize them because they've been given their own personal histories, and they seem to be very distinct. But really, when you get down to it and you get closer and closer to their primordial origins and what they refer to, which is the powers of the living world, then you see that they merge. You see the places where they overlap with each other.
Okay. Well, so they were from their parents, if you want to call them parents. What you said, they come from the living waters. So was Medusa always the woman with the snakes for hair, or is that just a patriarchal construct?
Very good question, because, one of the many stories said that she was once very beautiful and that she was raped by Poseidon. Okay, so who's Poseidon? Originally, Poseidon was the god of the sweet waters. He's the consort of the mother goddess, basically. He's an old European deity. He's not, until he was Indo-Europeanized. And when he was Indo-Europeanized, what I mean by that is that when the Greek tribes came down into the Balkan Peninsula, which became Greece, they brought with them the orientation towards sky gods. They brought with them a very, very different social structure, linguistic structure, that Maria called the collision of cultures between the old European and the Indo-European. One thing they brought was the horse. And when the horse appeared into what became Greece, somewhere around 2000 BC or second millennium BC, Whenever you see the horse appearing in story, you know that that is a trigger, or that is a sign of the Indo-European influence. So in the story about Medusa, who was once beautiful, being raped by Poseidon, first of all, and the old Poseidon would never rape her. It would be completely consensual. He's in his horse aspect. So he is raping her as a horse.
Mm.
And the story goes that he's actually raping her in Athena's precinct, sacred precinct. So Athena comes in and sees this going on, and does she become furious at Poseidon? No. She becomes furious with Medusa. So
this
she's blaming the victim.
Patriarchal.
It's very patriarchal.
Yeah.
So she curses Medusa for being raped in her precinct by Poseidon in his horse aspect, and turns her into this ugly, you know, being. Well, that's just a story, but it's just one layer of many stories. But it has certain key elements in it that we recognize that go down through thousands of years. But blaming the victim and so on.
Well,
anyway,
let me ask you this, and because, you know, talking about these myths as metaphor, I'm just curious if you agree with this. I had a scholar on the show at one point who was talking about how the Greeks, you know, they had all of these stories, but we take them too literally. And for instance, when Poseidon and Zeus and Hades were, you know, battling their parents, it really wasn't, you know, one set of gods battling another set of gods. It was really, you know, the change of, you know, from the way people were living into more organized civilization. You know, he also said that when we hear in, you know, Greek myth, for instance, you know, a god is raping a goddess, it's, you know, rather than thinking of it in a personified way, which is sort of it comes from Christian influence, he suggested that, you know, since the deities were really cosmic forces, so to speak, I'm using that kind of loosely, but if there was a rape, it wasn't necessarily an assault. It was sometimes it was just two cosmic forces that came together and created a third. Do you believe that? I mean, is that sort of, you know, part of the deeper meaning of the myths? If we don't, you know, personify the gods and the goddesses, or do you disagree?
Well, okay. First of all, I agree with what Maria Gimbutas said in terms of the. She was talking about the old European symbolism, and she said their ties with nature persist, that if you trace them back, you know, you what you find are those powers of the natural world, and that the mythology functions as a way of personifying or of bringing to close what otherwise is vast, so you can have a relationship with it.
Mm.
Those are my words, you know, basically, but explanatory words. I mean, she didn't say it exactly that way, but she did say their ties with nature persist. Okay, so on that level, yeah, but by the time you get these stories, you also have them illustrated very specifically over and over and over and over and over and over again. And you see that this is a rape. You see the women and the goddesses fleeing. You see, I mean, this is it. This is a sport. This is a sport that Zeus and all of the heroes do. They go out, and it's a lusty sport, and guys will be guys. And this is, you know, and I think at that stage of the development of Greek civilization, I don't think...
There was going to be a tone for behavior.
There was a tone for behavior.
Yeah.
There was, and there was a justifying the tone and so on. So, you know... I'm not willing to justify that particular inflection or that those particular stories by saying, well, really, they didn't really mean it that way. Well, I think at a certain point they did mean it that way.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
But anyway, especially if you look at the story of the Gorgon, because it's a cautionary tale. It becomes a cautionary tale because here you have this figure of Medusa who is demonized. Now, I have to say though, it's a little bit backstory before we kind of get into the decapitation and the Perseus and all that sort of thing. There are deep old European roots to what constellated into what is called Gorgon or what is called Medusa. And these deep roots have to do with those attributes that are, you can trace them back if you look at what the Gorgon looks like. The Gorgon has teeth, sharp teeth. These are the teeth of the predator. She has a lolling tongue. She has the snakes as hair. She has fangs. She has iron claws. And when she's personified as a whole being, not just a mask, she's seen flying through the air. She has snakes around her waist. She has all these different things that speak of her powers, her underwater powers, her ability to move freely under the water, her ability to fly beyond the horizon, her abilities to function in all the dimensions as powerful. Okay. But tracing them back, what you have is the bird of prey, which is connected to that one who devours you back, who's the one who tears you apart so that you can then take a new form to be regenerated. She's the birth giver, although she's not shown specifically giving birth except out of her decapitated head. She is the healer because her blood on one side is the blood of death and on the other side of her body the blood of life. So she has those aspects of death regeneration, birth death regeneration within her that have their precedent already all the way back into old Europe. So by the time she constellates in what's called the Gorgon, she starts out being just a face, just a mask that's described by Homer as coming up out of the underworld, this fearsome sound with this gargling kind of growling sound that is the kind of the root of her. The word Gorgon is something that's that onomatopoeia of that strangling sound. That is used not only on the shields of warriors, but it's also used as what's called a Gorgonian, up as a protector, as an apotropaic image to protect anything that needs to be protected. Sacred precincts, many, many times they are in high places in Greek temples, and on and on and on and on. Very, very much a powerful threshold guardian. So that's the positive use of this figure. But another aspect of her being the protector is that this figure on the shield of the warriors, as described by Homer, she's described also as what's called the bearded Aphrodite, and sometimes you see her as bearded. And that relates, in terms of all the literature that I've read, and I think it's a very, very interesting explanation, that she represents the woman's genitals, the female genitals, that her mouth with those teeth and that lolling tongue is basically the toothed vagina. And she is used as a protector because the exposing of the female genitals is a very, very, very powerful protective gesture.
So are we saying in a roundabout way the demonizing of Medusa is men's fear of women's sexuality, fertility, life-giving force?
Yes. Yes. And when you have the rise of the hero, at a certain point you have the rise of the hero who is given the task to subdue those powers in female form. That's his job. And what is he really doing? it's that consciousness that has shifted from being in harmony with the whole cycles of the natural world, in which you come into being and you accept the inevitability of going out of being and then returning in some other way because you're part of the life force. Once there was what Campbell called the great reversal, you have this resistance to releasing the ego, releasing then this idea that I can dominate this. I'm not going to go back. And that woman is associated then with that reality that is ultimately inescapable, but that has to be fought over and over again, that we're going to die. We, no matter how powerful we think we are, we're going to come apart at the seams, and there's going to be no more of us. Unless they know that they're part of everything, you see. So there was this resistance. The great reversal was fight it all the way down.
So in other words, then within the female, you have humankind's resistance to death, resistance to the natural cycles of life. So this isn't necessarily a gender thing. It's more not wanting to, thinking that you can overcome, arrogance, ego, thinking that you can overcome the natural cycles.
There's that aspect that affects everyone. I could, of course, you can say that, but in terms of the way it presents itself, in terms of the stories and the iconography, and that cultures that are patriarchally oriented, that are hierarchically oriented, in which they have the idea that the male god is at the top, and that there's a hierarchy of god, man, woman, the kids, the animals, that aligned up that way, that there is a gender difference. There is an association between women's bodies, with that being reminded that you're going to die. As soon as you're born, you are given basically the gift that you're going to die. You can't get out of this alive. And this whole struggle of the hero, the whole struggle of the whole patriarchal system is to control that. Interestingly enough, there's a lot of war that is part and parcel of the patriarchal system. And to die as a hero means you have eternal life. I mean, it's,
So you've beaten it then.
You've beaten it. If you die as a hero because you're defending the order, the world order of domination, then that's fine. But if you just die because, you just grow old and die, or you've given yourself to these natural cycles, that's disgusting. You're
right.
No man. You're not,
right.
It's just like the whole project is going to collapse if people, are going to be like that, especially men.
So they've created this construct to overcome the inevitable.
Yes, to try to control it over and over and over again. And so the female body is the reminder that of this inevitability. And so what you have in terms of the story of Medusa and Athena is you have Athena, who is brought through, whose lineage is swallowed. She's reborn through the head of Zeus, through that consciousness of domination. She comes out fully armed with a battle cry, saying that she is in his service. She brings all the arts of civilization for Zeus, and she devotes herself to working with and being of service to the heroes,
so they can have everlasting life and therefore deny their mortality, and that they're going to die and just go back into the earth, and there's nothing beyond it, that there really is an immortality.
Being a hero is noble. Not if you choose not to fight, then you're going to be destroyed by the, men have a hard time, because the man who doesn't fight, the man who doesn't join this pr- project is going to be destroyed, is going to be belittled, or it's going to be, you know, they can't be allowed to be. So, but I want to get back to this story, because the decapitation of Medusa, you have this young bloke, Perseus, and he's sent on this mission to kill Medusa. Okay, well, he doesn't know what she looks like. He doesn't know where she is. He doesn't know how to do it. So Athena's there, and she says, you know, here's who she is. Here's where she lives. Here, you know, she goes to Hermes and gets the winged sandals. She gets the helmet of invisibility. She gets the scythe, which looks like a crescent moon. And she gets this bag, the special bag that opens up to receive the head. And so he can fly. Now he can be invisible. Now he has the power of killing her. And he's being guided by Athena, who knows where she is because this is her alter ego, right? So where do the Gorgons live? They live in a cave. It's their, you know, they live in this, in the cave in the earth, right? On an island at the far edge of the Western Ocean, that place, that liminal place between death and regeneration. And that is the place where Hera planted the tree, basically the Axis Mundi, the tree that is of the golden apples, that is guarded by the sweet singing Hesperides. It's like that's the center of the world, even though it's depicted as being on the periphery, and there's the old alchemical saying that the center and the circumference are one. So he has to go there at the far edge, that place, that liminal place, to find them. And in many different variations of the story, but one of them, Medusa is asleep in the cave, and Athena takes him in and guides his hand to kill her. And then they skin her body. Actually, Athena skins her and uses her skin as her aegis. I mean, there are other stories about what the skin, you know, not all stories say that she skins Medusa, but there is one story that says that Medusa's skin is what she's wearing on her breastplate. And then, of course, we all know that the miniature of her, of Medusa's face, is right there.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's who she really is, too, and she's denied who she really is. And so after the head is after Medusa is decapitated, out of that bloody neck is born the children that she was pregnant with because of her break from Poseidon, and one of them is the winged horse.
Oh.
And of course he's a horse because, you know,
right.
Pegasus, and the other is Creosor, her son, and they all have stories, but every part of her is taken apart. She's cut apart. Her blood is given to to Asclepius. Her blood, which kills and heals, is given to Asclepius, so he then can become the great healer.
Hmm.
It's her power of death regeneration.
Right. It's not his own.
It's not his own. The flashing of her eyes is given to Zeus, and that's the flashing of the lightning.
Oh.
The roar of her roar is his thunder. And it goes on and on and on like that. So she's all taken apart. Just as when Tiamat is killed by Marduk in the Mesopotamian myth, she's cut apart. She's, you know, and Marduk makes the world out of her body. It's that taking of those primordial powers in female form and usurping them for the hero, for the patriarchy,
for the male,
for the new world order.
Right.
So anyway, this is a cautionary tale. So what we get then is, okay, girly, who do you think you want to be in this life? If you are like Athena, who is so noble, she is noble. She has all the arts of civilization, and she is pure. She is a virgin, and she is in service to the father and all the heroes, and she carries Zeus's shield to protect her. You could be like that, or you could be like that, the other one that's demonized. And you know what you're going to get? You're going to get killed over and over again. That's your choice. I mean, that's our choice. It's the good girl or the virgin,
right,
or the whore.
Right. And, you know, it's choosing this new, you know, the status quo, you know, the new world order, the patriarchy, or you see what you'll get.
Right. And, you know, the Inquisition was all about that. It's just destroying women. So if anyone thinks that they can manifest any of our primordial powers, any of the powers that are within us as women, as human beings, forget it. And then there's this ripple effect going down through generations. And I at one point I thought to myself, what does the mother teach the daughter so that the daughter can survive? You know?
Well, have you found that for women? Is that what does she point to? You know, what do we have left in the myths that teach the woman to stand up, you know, stand up against the new world order and be your true self?
Well, interestingly, in the Greek period, there were times they were still allowed a certain vestige of the old religion in which, you know, women could get together and celebrate the Thesmophoria, for instance, or, you know, you can come out and you can do it, and then you better get back in and behave.
Give you a little taste of it to sort of just pacify you.
Yeah,
but,
and I think it's because it was so powerful, and that for so many millennia women were doing these rituals, and that they wouldn't not allow themselves not to, they wouldn't give up everything.
Right.
In other words.
Right. Well, the great reversal, though, Joan. What do we think was the cause for that? I mean, was it just about cheating death? You know, or was it just, you know, civilization was becoming more sophisticated and they deluded themselves, thinking that they didn't have to succumb to the natural cycles. And as a side question of that, if you weren't a hero, then if you were a woman, for instance, or you were a man who didn't fight, then what happened to you if you didn't have the chance to achieve immortality?
Or if you're being attacked, you have to fight back.
Right.
If you're going to, you know, protect the people you love, you know, or you just lay down and, you know, we roll over you. I think that it's a big, big subject. And one of the problems with trying to discuss that aspect of it is that it's such a big subject, and it takes so much to talk about it in any kind of detail that makes sense, that is so often reduced to kind of a thumbnail sketch and then considered so simplistic it's just kind of, you know, oh, that's, you know, that can't happen. But I have been studying for years Maria's Kurgan theory. She tried to answer for herself what happened in Europe, because at the end of old Europe, there was this, after thousands of years of peacefulness, suddenly, you know, there was a change. And what was that change? How did that come about? And she answered that for herself by also, through her linguistic work, also at the same time answering the question of how did Europe become Indo-Europeanized? How did the Indo-European languages spread? And how did that spread also happen in other areas of the world? I mean, even down into India and beyond. And what she says is that nomadic pastoralists living north of the Black Sea and the area, the steppe region, had a very, very different social structure. It was based on being territorial. It was based on being sky-oriented, in which the inflection of the sacred was more toward the male, because these were warrior peoples. And at a certain point, perhaps because of the desiccation of the steppe, climate change, whatever the factors were, they began their out-migrations into Europe and came into the areas of old Europe, these old, mature, stable, societies that had all the arts of civilization. And then it was like a domino effect that Europe after that point was never the same. And, you know, I mean, it's,
so,
it's
so
a big
story.
So the
Great Reversal and the Kurgan invasion, they're synonymous in
yes.
a sense. Okay.
I think
okay.
so, but if you're going to answer that question for, you have to look at what part of the world are you talking about, because this kind of change happened in many different places for different reasons.
And probably over long periods of time, so there's not
yeah.
just one answer, right?
Exactly.
Well,
so,
like you said, this is a complicated subject. We could talk about it for a long time, and we are starting to run out of time. So let's do this, because we probably have about 10 minutes. If someone wanted to read more about this and go into more depth, which of Maria's books would you recommend they pick up and read about this for themselves?
Well, I would recommend the Civilization of the Goddess. Are you talking about the transformation, the change, the Great Reversal? Are you talking
yeah,
about
I
that
think
aspect?
So. Yeah, that aspect
yeah.
of it.
Chapter 10 is that. But unfortunately, the book is out of print. I mean, you can get copies, out of print copies.
On Amazon or something?
Yeah, I mean, just go out on the net. But, you know, what their collection of Maria's papers chronicling the development of her theory about the Kurgan invasions, the collision of culture, has been collected into a book that is called The Kurgan Culture, and it's edited by Miriam Robbins Dexter and Carlene Jones Bly, published by the Journal of Indo-European Studies. And of course, this is all academic stuff.
Right.
And it can be a little bit overwhelming to people who kind of, you know,
yeah.
don't want to get into it on that level.
Well, okay, so, and also, too, let's make sure we mention your website.
Right.
It's the, you know, the archaeomythology. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? And that'll probably just leave us enough time to sort of talk about the idea of, you know, Medusa being a potent image for women, you know,
yes,
how we can restore our own Medusa head on our wisdom body.
Absolutely. Before we do that, and it's very important, I think, to conclude that way, I do want to say that Christina Biaggi has edited, a very important anthology called The Rule of Mars, in which she looks at that shift to patriarchy. And it's discussed by scholars from many different disciplines, and it's really a great anthology. I contributed a book about the Kurgan theory, but it's published by Knowledge, Ideas, and Trends.
Okay.
And the again, the author is Christina Biaggi, B-I-A-G-G-I, and you could Google it and
the
get a copy.
The Rule of Mars.
The Rule of Mars. It's really
okay.
a very important anthology.
Okay. Let me just say real quickly, Lear Keith, I know she's on the switchboard, and as soon as we conclude our conversation, I'll be chatting with her. So I just wanted to give her a heads up that I know she's there. So, but thank you, Joan. So that's Rule of Mars by Christina Biaggi, and an anthology that would explain this from different disciplines. You're saying.
Right, the transition to patriarchy.
Okay,
and
your archaeomythology website?
Yes, the archaeomythology website. First of all, I created that to continue Maria's work, and it's archaeomythology.org, and the new website is in the process of being put up. And it's going to have, it doesn't have yet because we're still in process, a whole section on Maria, her whole bibliography and papers. And anyway, but as you probably know from your own website work, it's it's really an interesting challenge. But
yeah.
but do take a look at it. And yeah, and in terms of the looking at the image of Medusa as important for women of our time, that she represents this fierceness at the center. She represents this consciousness of the powers of the cycles of the natural world, and that we have those powers within us. And we have the fierceness of the protective mother. We have the fierceness of the lioness. We have the fierceness of the one who is not going to allow our children to be harmed, or the earth to be harmed. And she is the one who's been demonized, but we need to take that decapitated head and put it back on the wisdom body, the body that knows what is necessary for life, what is necessary for a full experience of living in peace and in abundance with each other, and to have the courage to step forward and to speak what is true within us.
Well, and I think, too, it's also about not being duped into denying our own power.
Absolutely. Because we've been demonized, because we've been told we were ugly, because we've been told we don't matter, because we've been told all of those things that reduce our capacities. And there is a beautiful image I usually end with when I'm presenting about Medusa, and it comes from a temple in Magna Graecia, which is in southern Italy, and it's beam ends. It's the image of the Gorgon face put at the end of beams all along the edge of the roof. And it's this radiantly beautiful, smiling image of the Gorgon's face with her fangs, with her tongue, with her eyes that see through all appearances, and with the snakes all around her, that she has her full powers and she knows it. Therefore, she doesn't have to be raging all the time. That at the center, like Vicki Noble says, to quiet down and amp up.
Mm-hmm.
So
good
that whenever we need to have, you know, that roar, whenever
right.
we need to run out and save the child from being run over,
right.
or save, you know, whatever it is, we have it there. But we don't have to be raging all the time.
Well, and it hasn't done us any good to be good little sheeple either.
No.
You know,
so we
I
have
mean,
to know
of...
our powers. We have to know our powers and be, and I think that gives us centering, that gives a sense of who we are and what our capacities are.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm from the South, and I don't know whether 20-year-old girls still get this message growing up in the South, but, you know, it was always about, you know, don't make waves, be polite, and, you know, that doesn't do us any good.
Right, right, exactly. So we have to think for ourselves. We have
Absolutely.
To be present with all of our faculties and all of our capacities ready. Yeah. There's
Absolutely.
So much more that can be said, so much more that could be said about the Gorgon Medusa and this, that we've just scratched the surface, but at least it's the beginning.
It's a beginning. And Joan, thank you so much for your time tonight. It's been very interesting. And I'm just wondering, I know you have some papers on the Gorgon and that. Are there links to anything like that anywhere, or you only get the benefit of that if maybe you're in your class or something?
Well, this article that I sent to you was published a few years ago in Revision Journal. And I'm thinking of republishing it so that it's more available, and actually putting it on the website of the Institute of Archaeomythology. And our Journal of Archaeomythology is published there, and it has just become an open source journal, so that all you have to do is just register, and then you give yourself a password and username, and then you can go in and have full access. And at some point, hopefully sooner than later, the Gorgon article will be there.
Okay, wonderful.
Take down.
Well, thank you, Joan, because, I mean, we really do have to, you know, sort of get it, you know, through the thick skulls of women out there not to be handmaidens of the patriarchy, you know. Don't worry about being demonized, because, you know, we do have to save the world.
Yes, and having the powers of protection is also who we are. And sometimes that means, you know, we have to be fierce. It doesn't mean that we're, you know, always nice. It doesn't mean that we're always raging. But our powers are expressed in a way that's appropriate to the situation.
Absolutely. Absolutely, whether we're talking Kali or we're talking Sekhmet or we're talking the Mezusa or the Morrigan, you know, we have to be able to feel comfortable embracing that sacred roar, whether we're defending the earth or ourselves or some species that's disappearing on the planet or whatever the case may be.
Exactly, and since you brought up Kali, you could see that Medusa is the European Kali. I mean, there are so many parallels there. I mean,
okay.
there are differences, too, but there are parallels as well.
Okay. Well, Joan, thank you so much for the work that you do, and I really appreciate your time tonight, and have a wonderful trip to Turkey.
Thank you, and thank you, Karen, for the work that you do. It's very excellent, and it's very needed.
Well, thank you. We're all just doing what we've, you know, our little piece of it.
Right.
Well, good
okay.
night.
Thank you. Good night.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these values and benchmarks have the substance to save the world. You've been listening to Joan Marler discussing the relevance of the Gorgon Medusa. Women out there, you might want to consider having Medusa on your altars. You might want to restore your own Medusa head on your wisdom body and come into your full power, as Joan says. We women need to take control from the people destroying our planet and quality of life. We need to really be the change. So, as we cross the threshold into the second part of the show, I have to share with you listeners the true synchronicity at play so often at the show here. You know, I don't actually consciously plan it this way, but it happens so often that both of my guests in some way complement each other. Tonight it's warrior women, warrior goddesses as an overarching theme, from Joan Marler, who's had to stand up for the views of our foremother Maria Gimbutas, teaching us about the Gorgon Medusa associated with Artemis, Hecate, Athena, Kali, to our next guest, a woman standing in her own power, controversial in some circles, taking on the establishment and status quo that's killing the planet, species, and humankind. I think she's in like-minded company tonight, as myself and you out there no doubt have ideas and views radically different than the mainstream sometimes. So let me say hello to the author of The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability, and Deep Green Resistance, A Strategy to Save the Planet. Lear Keith is with us. Welcome, Lear.
Thanks for having me on your show, Karen. Joan was great, and there's even more synchronicity because I actually heard Joan speak once when Maria Gimbutas was still alive. Twice, actually, I heard Maria and Joan both present, and it was incredibly moving to me, both personally and politically. So I'm thrilled to be on after Joan.
Well, you know, I feel like this is all pieces of the same puzzle. You know, it really is. And if we had never lost these myths, then maybe we would not be in the position we're in today. And there it goes. But at least we're remembering it and we're reclaiming it.
I couldn't agree more.
So Lear, you are the author of two great books, The Vegetarian Myth, as I said before, Food Justice and Sustainability, and Deep Green Resistance, Strategy to Save the Planet. We're going to try to talk a little bit about both of these, sort of get out of the myth and into the actual world, how losing these myths, and how we've become out of touch with nature and the cycles of life, and what that's really cost us, because this is all interconnected, in a big picture way. So why don't we start with what is the vegetarian myth?
Well, I always like to start by really emphasizing that the values that underlie vegetarianism are not at issue. And I think that most people are attracted to vegetarianism because they really value things like compassion and justice and sustainability and any critique of human hubris and human entitlement. Those are the only values that are really going to get us to the world that we need, and those are values that I share very deeply. So that's not the problem. I think that we have the values right. The problem is information. And so it's a very deep cultural ignorance about the nature of nature and then the nature of agriculture. And I mean, even on the fringes of the environmental movement, no one is questioning agriculture. They don't know how, they don't know that they should, they don't know what it is. So that's, you know, the place where I usually start is to say...
Well, let me just ask you, when you say questioning agriculture, are you talking about like genetically modified food and Monsanto, or are you talking about something else?
I'm not just talking about industrial agriculture. To my mind, industrialization is an accelerant to this process, but the process itself is inherently destructive. So, you know, if you want to understand what agriculture is, you know, in very brute terms, you take a piece of land and then you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So what it is biotic cleansing. And that's not agriculture on a bad day. That's what agriculture is. You clear that land. And what it means is mass extinction, because all the plants and animals, and even down to the microorganisms, all those creatures that are doing the basic work of life are wiped off, and they have nowhere else to go. And right now we are losing 200 species every single day to extinction. This is the largest mass extinction event that the planet has ever experienced. And the basic activity that has been driving that for 10,000 years is agriculture.
I see.
So that's number one, is that it's biotic cleansing. Number two, the second problem, secondary to that, is because you're not sharing that land, what it means is that you're only growing humans on it. And this has let the human population grow to some pretty extraordinary numbers, and it's simply because we're not sharing it. And then the final problem is that this is drawdown. It's destroying not just those living communities, but the basic activity of those living communities is, in fact, building soil, because soil is the basis of land life. We owe our entire existence to 6 inches of soil and the fact that it rains. Without that, there is no life. I mean, there could be life in the oceans, and there was once without land life, but land, you know, on the continents could not be here. It all depends on that soil. And every time you clear that land, you're destroying the soil. So we've been on this drawdown for 10,000 years. At this point, we've skinned the planet alive. We are out of topsoil, and we have been since 1950. So we've made ourselves dependent on this activity, agriculture, which in fact is inherently destructive, and we are now up against the cliff, because since 1950, we've been using fossil fuel instead of fossil soil. And eventually the fossil fuel is going to run out too. So this is not a plan with the future.
So, all right. So let me ask you a few questions about all of that. So you are considered so controversial, I would assume, because it sounds like you're against agriculture. But how would you tell humankind, how would they feed themselves? I mean, obviously, we've let the population get too big. So you have people like Monsanto saying, well, you know, if you don't, you know, do what we say, the planet is going to starve. But is there another alternative?
Well, human societies that are actually sustainable are ones that are not drawing down their land base. And for our first 4 million years as, you know, bipedal hominoids on this planet, we in fact did that. You know, we were part of those soil-building communities. We were part of those cycles of life and death and eating and being eaten. We were not destroying monsters. That is a very recent activity. So to my mind, it would not be hard, you know, to look back over our history and realize that we do actually know how to integrate ourselves into those living communities, that was what we knew how to do, you know, from the beginning. And it's really very, very recent that we've taken up this other sort of activity. Lauren Cordain, who's an expert in Paleolithic nutrition, I mean, he uses this great metaphor of a football field, which you can imagine how big a football field is. And all of our time on this planet, up until like the last 2 inches of that football field, we lived as hunter-gatherers or possibly horticulturalists. And, you know, we participated in those cycles of life. We didn't destroy them. And it's only like the last 2 inches that agriculture comes in and, you know, we're sort of living with the consequences now in terms of species extinction, in terms of drawdown of, you know, all the non-renewable resources, global warming, you know, all of the horrors that are sort of coming due now. It all goes back to that moment when we decided that for whatever reason we were going to take over ecosystems rather than being participants in them.
Okay.
Okay, so... Good.
Okay. So, all right. So on the vast timeline of history, it's only recently that we've accelerated everything and made it really bad. So what kind of time frame are we talking about? When did we start to go wrong?
10,000 years ago, that in the Middle East, in the Levant, that was when agriculture, the first place that agriculture began. And agriculture arose in seven different centers around the globe at different times, but the first one was 10,000 years ago. And it all started in river valleys, and there's a reason for that. Agriculture depends on annual grains, on annual grasses, and so areas of massive disturbance, flood, that is what creates the need for lots of annual plants in those ecosystems. So those annual grasses were then domesticated by humans and hence agriculture. Because they're annuals, and this is an important point, that's why that land has to be cleared. They can't compete against perennials. And their role in nature is really very important. They're like the first responders after an emergency. So when there's an emergency like a fire or a flood, that's when the annuals spring to life. Their seeds usually lie dormant in the soil for a long, long time. But the moment that the perennials are cleared away by some kind of emergency, then the annuals spring to life. And they will protect the soil. And that's really their job, because it's just a biological emergency to have the soil cleared for any reason. So they spring to life, they protect the soil, and within a year or two, the perennials have more or less knitted back into place. So the analogy I like to use is like if you cut yourself and then you put a Band-Aid on it, the annuals are a Band-Aid, and they're holding the skin together, protecting it. And bit by bit, you know, the skin and the other tissues will grow back, and that's what the perennials do. And it's really the perennial plants that are the ones that create topsoil and provide habitat and make oxygen and do all those things that the rest of us really need. And the annuals are just sort of the fallback plan in case there's an emergency. And the problem with agriculture, go ahead.
But the agriculture upsets that balance, I assume.
It doesn't just upset it destroys it entirely, because the land has to be completely cleared. It's the only way that those seeds have a chance, is to clear the land, is to clear either the plants, you know, whether they're trees or grasses, they have to be completely removed. So think about if you're going to grow lettuce and you look out at your lawn and you see grass, what do you have to do? You've got to dig up the grass. And
right.
Then you can plant lettuce and tomato and corn, whatever you're going to plant, but you have to clear what's there. Because nature does not want to be an annual monocrop. She wants to be a perennial polyculture. And that's what keeps the soil in place. It's what protects the soil. It's what builds soil. I mean, grasses are amazing creatures at building topsoil. That's their main job on this planet. And then they provide food and habitat for, you know, pretty much everybody else. They also store water, and, you know, they draw minerals from way deep down, from the rocks that are, you know, the basis of the planet. Annuals can't do that. They don't have deep roots the way that trees and perennial grasses do. So without them, we would run out of minerals. There simply wouldn't be any. So that's what the perennials do.
So how would things have to change on the planet for us to get back to a healthier way of feeding ourselves?
Well, there's other food systems that people have developed that are based on perennial rather than based on annuals. And to my mind, anything that's based on that sort of perennial skeleton, you've got a chance at least of being sustainable, because that's the only way to build topsoil. So whether it's hunter-gatherers, whether it's horticulturalists, whether it's pastoralists, and those are sort of the three basic models of ways that people have participated in soil-building communities in ways that could certainly be considered sustainable pretty much forever, you know, until the sun burns out.
Okay, I'm going to have to ask you to spoon feed us a little bit, because I'm sure my listeners don't know the difference between horticulturists, pastoralists. What does that really? I mean, is it possible to explain what that really means without making our eyes glaze over? I mean, what would be different in society, compared to what we're doing now? Those different methods. How are they different? And could we feed everybody on the planet if we did that?
We could not feed everybody on the planet, but the truth is we can't feed anybody on the planet with what we're doing. The only reason we have the amount of food that we do is because in 1950, the war economy shifted to producing, instead of bombs, they shifted to making fossil fuel fertilizers, with nitrogen that was chemically produced using something called the Haber-Bosch process, which was a wartime activity. And they decided they could make nitrogen instead for fields to grow corn and wheat and whatever. And that's what we've been eating since 1950. So every time you take a bite of wheat or corn or soy or rice or whatever, you're eating oil on a stalk. We're out of topsoil, okay? It was gone by 1950. We had blown through it all across that 10,000 years. So nothing we do is going to produce this amount of grain forever because it's based on drawdown. It's based on fossil fuel. And
okay, so when somebody is driving out in the let's just say the Midwest, okay, and they see these fields of growth, or here I'm thinking, okay, I'm in California. I drive up the 5, and I mm-hmm. you know, you go from vineyard to vineyard or farm to farm, and you see them growing everything. There really isn't topsoil there. I'm confused. Forgive me. Forgive my ignorance. I buy my food in the grocery store. I think most of us don't understand this.
Right. Well, every time you clear that land to plant something, you're losing soil. And, you know, to put a number on that, one season of growing your basic row crop like corn or soy or wheat, you can destroy 2,000 years of topsoil. It takes a century to grow an inch of soil under natural conditions. And so every time you clear off the native grasses or the native forests and you bare that land to plant those annual agricultural crops, every time you do that, you're losing soil. And that's what has to be done year after year after year to do agriculture. The land has got to be cleared, and then those annuals can be planted. And that's the problem with this model. That's why it's been on drawdown for 10,000 years.
So even the idea of rotating crops, I mean, I can remember back in my, you know, back somewhere that I read that, you know, rotating crops helps, you know, gives the soil the chance to restore itself. That's not even enough help.
It's better than not doing it because each plant is going to draw slightly different minerals out of the soil. But ultimately, anything that is just annuals after annuals after annuals, it's drawdown. There's no way around it. The plants don't have the root systems. They don't live long enough. They can't pull up minerals from deep below. And at the end of the season, they have to clear it to plant it again for the next year. So that's the end of the soil. I had a biology professor when I was 20 who said the following sentence to me, which was burned into my brain. He said, the moment you put a plow to soil, you destroy that soil. And he showed us pictures of the, you know, the Middle East where agriculture began. That was a cedar forest once upon a time. It was forest so thick that sunlight never touched the ground. And now you look at that, nobody in their right mind would call Iraq the Fertile Crescent. I mean, it's a desert, and that is the ultimate endpoint of agriculture each and every time.
Well, I guess we just, I thought it was just climate change, but no, you're saying it's not just climate change, it's they've destroyed their topsoil.
Yes, and destroying the forest, of course, means that there's less rain, and so it becomes a very vicious cycle.
I see.
The perennial plants actually bring the rain, and so without the forests or without the grasses, then there's a lot less rain every year. The soil also can't absorb the water without those deep perennial roots. Those make channels that actually suck the water down. So then there's less water every year for that reason as well, and so then it's just this vicious cycle. And then you reach a tipping point where it just becomes desert, and it's really hard to bring it back.
All right, so now I understand what you're talking about, why vegetarianism won't save the world. I mean, we're thinking that, you know, we're going to, we don't want to eat meat because maybe, we don't want to eat things with eyes, and, you know, we know about factory farming, how cruel that is. So you switch over to vegetarianism, whether it's because of the cruelty to animals or you just want to, you feel like you're eating more healthy, but it's obviously still it's got its own tragic story attached. All right, so
it's not a story that we tell because we live in an agricultural society, and you know, add to that the fact that most of us at this point live in the industrial version of that. I mean, farming at this point is considered a statistically insignificant occupation in the United States because less than 2% of the population actually does it. We don't have the first clue what's going on in Nebraska or Iowa. We don't know where our food comes from. We don't know the cost of it. So all we know is that we look at our plates and we say, well, did something die to get onto this plate? And if it was an animal, we say, yes, something died. And if it's a plant, we say, well, no, nothing really died. But the real question is way bigger. The question is, what else died to get this food on my plate? And if you're eating agricultural foods, the sad truth is the entire world has died to get that food onto your plate.
Well, Lear, I guess, though, you must have an idea for a solution. Can anything be done at this point? Or, I mean, are we past the point of no return?
I don't think we're past the point of no return. And I say that because the planet has an incredible capacity to regenerate. Life wants to live. And if we simply stopped waging this war against the forests and the grasses, they would come back. And one of the most hopeful numbers that I can give people is that if right now in the United States, if we repaired even 75% of the trashed out grasslands that are east of the Dakotas, the United States within a year could become a carbon sequestering nation. That's a pretty incredible number. If we were to repair even 75% of the grasslands that have been destroyed around the planet, that would mean that within maybe 12 or 13 years, we could sequester all of the carbon that's been released since the beginning of the industrial age. Carbon would drop to 330 parts per million, which is way below that 350 mark that, you know, like Bill McKibben and other people sort of have as their benchmark, because grasses are incredibly good at building soil. It is their job. And if we would just let them come back and do their job, we really could put this to an end. And the question is, do we have, one, the understanding, two, the passion, three, the political will, and four, the love, really, because we have to love those grasses and the creatures that need to live there if we're going to let them come home.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just, you know, on this continent, what that really means is the bison, because the Midwestern prairie, the great prairie here, can't exist without the bison. And there were at one point 60 million bison on this continent. We've traded them in for 40 million tortured cows. It's insane. I mean, it doesn't even make any sense on an economic level. But, you know, you could sit on a rock once upon a time, and for 4 days the bison herd would run by. I mean, that's how many animals there were. And they've
right.
all been displaced by, you know, monocrop wheat and soy and corn.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, I don't, you know, this is probably irrelevant, but when you said the bison, I can't help but think about, you know, the stories we would hear or the movies we would see about, you know, when the Wild West was tamed and, you know, so many heads of bison were just slaughtered, you know, and it's tragic, but, you know, I guess kind of a separate story. But the grasslands, I mean, who owns these grasslands? I mean, is this like in the hands of individual farmers or multinational corporations? I mean, what would it take for, you know, someone to say, okay, we have to do this? I mean, would it take a an effort of government and a private enterprise? What would it involve? I mean, is it possible for that sort of coordination to even happen?
I think it's very possible, and one of the reasons that I say that, the other thing that gives me hope about this is that the farmers who actually switch to grass-based farming, usually within a year, they can already make a profit. As serfs to Monsanto and Cargill and Continental, growing things like wheat and corn, they can never make a profit. And the only reason that they're in business every year is because of the way we've set up the farm subsidies in this country, which is an insane system. I mean, we can get into that if you want to, but it's crazy. There's six corporations that essentially control the world food supply, so they have a monopoly around the globe. And because they have a monopoly, they're able to drive the price of grain below the cost of production. So every year, no matter how hard those farmers work, and they work very hard, they can never make a profit. So every year they're about to go bankrupt, and then the federal government steps in and makes up the difference such that they don't go bankrupt. And that money goes directly into the pockets of those six corporations. So it's an incredibly vicious cycle. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about India or whether you're talking about the United States, the number one cause of death in farm country is suicide. Okay, so it doesn't matter whether you're living in a rich country or a poor country or something in between. If you're a farmer, you're sort of in the fourth world. In India, they tend to commit suicide by drinking industrial poison, and in the United States, they do it by throwing themselves into machinery. And that's the only difference. Okay, so
they're doing that
serve.
Because they're simply so depressed about the state of things,
Yeah, no matter how hard they work, they have no control over. They cannot command the price. who commands the price is the corporations. So no matter how hard they work, they can never get their heads above water, and they're absolutely dependent on the federal government to make up the difference. So if the farm bill goes a little bit bad, you know, from year to year, then they're out of business and they lose everything.
So really, our tax dollars then, with the farm subsidies, our tax dollars are keeping the farmers from going out of business, even though their business, you know, they're in this cycle that doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, and then what happens is because the grain is subsidized to that level, these giant corporations do what's called agricultural dumping. So they go to poor countries and they flood the market with cheap corn or cheap rice or cheap whatever, and then it drives the local farmers out of business in the same way. So all the local economies have collapsed one by one by one around the globe. So these calls for us to, you know, somehow eat less meat means, oh, there'll be more grain, and then that grain can feed starving people. The model is completely backwards, because even if more cheap grain was shipped to those countries, that is the last thing you want, because all it does is it destroys their local economies and either drives the farmers into suicide or into urban squalor because they lose their land. And if you talk to food activists from anywhere else on the planet, they will tell you the number one thing they want is for us to get our fucking corporations out of their countries, because it's killing their local economies, and the only chance they have for a dignified life, for self-sufficiency, for community, you know, self-sufficiency, and for basic justice. So we've just had this model completely backwards for, you know, 30 or 40 years now. This kind of corporate dumping, agricultural dumping, is never going to lead to anything but more starvation and more suffering in poor countries. So, and the plight of the farmers all around the world is exactly the same, and it's for the same reasons, because of that monopoly power. So to get back to your other question, though, which was about how do we fix this, in fact, when these poor farmers can switch from that kind of the agricultural commodity production, when they can switch to grass-based farming again, they can, in the first year, can make a profit even. It's extremely, it's just a lot easier to make a living when you're actually not fighting a war against the planet, when you can actually set the price for what it is you're growing, and in this case it would be grass-fed beef or bison, and then especially if you can sell directly to the consumer. So one thing that we need to do is create more consumer awareness about how healthy these products are. Another thing is to set up more direct consumer farm-to-consumer networks, and there's plenty of groups that are doing that, especially groups like the Weston Price Foundation, that you know, on the local level, they set up those kinds of market potentials for the local farmers. And it's going to be a slightly larger project than just that, because the creatures that really need to be on the American prairie, as I said before, are bison. And the thing about bison is that they're not cows. They have different behavior and they have different needs, and they also bring in incredible gifts to that land. And they are really the creatures that belong here. They are able to withstand incredible cold as well as intense heat because of the insulation of the fur that they have, and they know how to handle themselves in both of those extremes. And one of the differences, which is fascinating to me, is that if a big snowstorm blows up, which of course you get on the Great Plains on a regular basis, the instinct of the bison is actually to walk into the wind. And what that means is they come out the other end of the storm a lot quicker. So they're walking into it, right? Cows will run from it because they're not from the Great Plains. They're really not built to withstand those kinds of temperatures. So they're in a lot longer, which means they die a lot sooner. A bison also migrate, and that's really the thing. But the thing about grasslands is that real grasslands actually migrate as well. There are long-term cycles of precipitation, of rain. And so the way to really think about grasslands is it's more like a snake than something that's stationary, because across decades, the grasslands will shift first to the east and then to the west and then back to the east. So it's almost a dance across the continent, depending on where in the rain cycle they are. So you've got the short stem, the medium, and then the tall grasses. And some of the, you know, they need more water or less water. So there's this dance across the continent, depending on where the water is. And the bison migrate with that, with those patterns. And they know where to go, where there's going to be, you know, better food at what time of the year, and they'll migrate to follow the rains. Cows don't do that because they're not from that kind of climate. So what this is going to mean, I think, is that we need to have a completely different kind of idea about private property. The West was carved up with a very, very small acreage in mind, thinking that the place should be plowed you know, planted to annual crops, and that a good size for that was something like 160 acres. Well, it was insane because there wasn't enough rain, and what it led to was the Dust Bowl, and there were farms in South Dakota that lost all of their topsoil on the first day of the Dust Bowl, and that's what happens when you clear land. But 160 acres is not a prairie. Prairies take place over thousands of acres, and so we're going to have a land ownership model that actually follows what prairies are. And so it's going to have to be some kind of collective ownership, some kind of community ownership of vast tracts of land, and then we're going to have to bring the bison back. But having done that, there would then be sustainable food forever.
Wow. Well, this is a complicated subject. This is a hugely complicated subject. And you know, I barely even know what to ask you. But I mean, it's obvious to me that multinational corporations are like the evil on the planet, you know, whether we're talking about agricultural multinational corporations or other industries as well. I mean, you know, they it seems like they are constantly the enemy of the indigenous people or the locals, you know, who end up, you know, being displaced, you know, for one reason or another. And I don't know, it just seems like to me an awful lot of education is going to have to be done. And I just wonder, I mean, do you ever feel like it's hopeless? I mean, do you ever wonder if the greed, you know, will ever be secondary to sustainability and survival?
You know, there's a couple ways to answer that just for me personally, because I am often overwhelmed by the sense of entitlement that people have in this culture. And underneath that, I find there's a level of sadism that just makes me ill. And I think that, to me, that's sort of the root of patriarchy, is that kind of cruelty, that sort of willful cruelty based on entitlement. And I don't know how to address that because it feels like a spiritual illness to me. And people either get out of that or they don't. And I think of Jack Forbes' book. He writes about the European culture as cannibals, that it's a cannibal sickness, and that, you know, it springs up in various places, but it came to this continent from Europe, and the cannibal sickness spread, and now it's infected a lot of the indigenous people as well. But he sees this as a spiritual illness, and I think that there is some truth to that, and at least that's how it feels to me.
Now, are you saying cannibal? Are you saying cannibal?
Cannibal, yeah, that's what he calls it, the cannibal sickness, yeah.
Because we're devouring each other, or?
Yeah, because on a spiritual level, you're just feeding on other people's fear and misery, and certainly on a physical level, the continent was just devoured. I mean, there's almost nothing left. As I said, there were 60 million bison, and now there's 1,200. I mean, that's all that's left.
Right,
I see. They took, yeah.
Well, I mean, and doesn't it go back to the Bible, you know, where, I mean, so many people, Christians, you know, felt entitled to dominate nature and man to dominate woman. I mean, doesn't it sort of track back to that? I mean, granted, we were, you know, we had agriculture before that, but this idea, I mean, you're calling it sadism, but then you also said entitlement. It feels like it's Abrahamic or Christian entitlement that, you know, maybe has us in that position too. I mean, is that part of the problem?
Yeah, I think that there's the basic myths that underlie Western culture are absolutely myths of agricultural peoples, and they are about domination. I mean, there's not a hunter-gatherer on the planet who has ever been told by her god or goddess, you know, to go out and conquer and subdue and to willfully overshoot your land base. I mean, it would be insane. Like, no rational person would listen to such a god, and yet that is the basic myth of Western culture. So I think you're exactly right on that point, that, you know, that's the story that's being told, and it's not just being told, you know, verbally, it's being told by the material institutions that are then created from that story. And, you know, one of them is certainly the practice of agriculture, because that's what that domination is.
All right. Well, before we jump to your next book, I feel ill-equipped, to maybe really even ask you the right questions. But is there any other point you wanted to make about, this idea of the what we've been talking about here? Anything else you feel like needs to be said to sort of round out the conversation before we start talking about the deep green resistance?
When you look at a wheat field or a cornfield, what you're looking at is a clear cut of the grass forest. And I really want people to understand that, that there should be this complex community of living creatures that are all working together to create more life and more soil and more life and more soil. And instead, what you've got is just that monocrop. And that is exactly the opposite process. And the only way to keep that opposite process going is really by waging a war against all those creatures who want to live there. So agriculture is a war against the living world. And the only reason we don't know that is because we're not doing it. It's because we live in these urban environments and we're not actually engaged in the practice itself. So I just want people to try to remember that and to find something in their hearts that can remember the bison or the black-footed ferrets or the prairie dogs or whatever creature it is that speaks to you, that they need you to fight for them and they really want their homes back. And that's really the only hope that I think we have is to restore those grasslands around the world. Without them, I think that the carbon is just going to kill us all. So we don't have much choice at this point. We really are going to have to restore those grasslands. But it would be better if we could do it because we love them, not just because we're desperate.
Right. Well, like you said, that would be nice, but realistically, it would probably more likely happen out of desperation than goodness of these corporations' heart because they have none.
Right.
But but I think the problem is most people are just totally unaware of this. You know, I just don't think they really get it. You know, they go in the grocery store and they see the multitudes, and they don't have any idea that this problem is looming. Yeah, you know, maybe they hear about we might run out of fossil fuels, but I don't know. I guess I don't think a lot of people realize that our food supply is really in danger too. I mean, you hear about Monsanto and genetically modified crops and all of that, but this aspect of it that you're talking about, I don't know, I think people hear less about.
Yeah, and it's interesting because even if you go back to the ancient Greeks, you've got Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle, all three of them talking about the fact that the world is being destroyed, that the topsoil is washing off the mountains, that the trees are gone, that the rivers are clogged, that there's no more fish, that the fertility seems to be leaving the world. And it's because of the deforestation and the farming. So it's, every generation or every 100 years, people living in these, quote, civilizations see the same process, but it's like nobody seems able to stop it once it gets started. And then the people living in the urban centers don't have a clue what's going on, out in the colonies where their food is actually being produced.
Right,
so that's
right.
The cycle that we've been on, and it's the same process. No matter, you can pick whichever civilization you want to pick, it ends, somewhere between 800 and 1,000 years later when the topsoil gives out, that power center collapses and then it goes out and it starts somewhere else. And at this point, the problem is that all the continents have been conquered. Okay, there's nowhere left to go. So it really has reached an absolute end. I mean, before, when civilizations collapsed, there was at least, it was like a human scale collapse, because each civilization could only get so big. And they were all, since they're dependent on their militaries, of course, to go out and conquer colonies and, bring home all the stuff that they thought they needed, it was limited by the distance that people could travel on foot or using pack animals. And so there's supply lines back and forth that, they had to get the raw materials and the food had to get back to the power center, and then the military orders had to get back out into the hinterlands. But that chain was very fragile because it took days and days, if not weeks and weeks, to get from one to the other. So each civilization could only get so big is really the take-home point. For instance, Rome could only get so big. I mean, Rome conquered all of northern Africa and then southern Europe and around the whole Mediterranean, turned northern Africa into a desert. I mean, that was the breadbasket of Rome, and you can see what it looks like now. Egypt was actually the private possession of the emperor because the Nile kept the wheat coming. And northern Europe was really saved because they couldn't get over the Alps. Otherwise, they would have conquered further. But eventually, the whole thing collapses, right? And then,
mm-hmm.
Starts again. And so each time, there's that sort of reboot where, another sort of nearby power center then is able to rise to dominance. But these were human-scale collapses. And there was always a forest that people could return to, during the worst of it. And the problem is now that there's nowhere left.
Right.
And so
because
collapse that we're facing, it's all, there's no more continents. I mean, Europe would have been over 500 years ago, except they discovered the Americas and took them as well. Now we've drawn down the soil here. I mean, 98% of the topsoil in the Canadian prairie is simply gone. It turned into dust, and it's gone. So, you know, this one's gone now, too. You know, so now we're eating fossil fuel, and everybody is in just vast amounts of denial about what's going to happen over the next generation. So, oh, gosh, that's depressing. I didn't mean to end on that note. Really, we could restore the prairies. It could be done. There are still bison.
Okay. All right. Well, not that it isn't important, but let's talk about the rest of this, because these are peripheral issues. I mean, your other book, Deep Green Resistance, Strategy to Save the Planet, well, you talked to him about, you know, there are ways to, you know, to save our food source, you know, the grasslands. But, all right, so in your book, Deep Green Resistance, first of all, what do you mean by resistance? Are you talking about, like, the Occupy movement? You know, people have to, you know, get off their couches and hit the streets. What are we really talking about?
Well, I think my main point is that there are no personal solutions to social and political problems. And so what that means is that people have to make common cause, and they have to work as a group, because what you're fighting is the group in power. So what it means is that we're going to have direct confrontations with the group in power. And what this means is that ultimately this is always about force. And when I say force, I'm not talking about violence. That's a completely separate discussion. All I mean is that that justice is not won by rational argument, and it's not won by individual transformation or by even a spiritual epiphany. It's really won by taking power away from the power elite and then dismantling their institutions. Because power is not a mistake, it's not a misunderstanding, it's not a disagreement. They do know what they're doing, and they do control things like, you know, the political process, the economic structures, and those are the things we are going to have to take back and run them democratically if we have any hope for either justice or sustainability. Because right now, of course, it's all being done for profit, and profit has nothing to do with human rights. In fact, it's quite the opposite. So,
right.
You know, we are going to have to get active, or some proportion of us is going to have to get active, and we're going to have to fight the good fight in whatever way we think is likely to win. And things are it's a gruesome situation. So, I don't try to tell other people what. I mean, we all have in our hearts the thing that we know we can do best. So it's not really up to me to tell other people, you know, what their gifts are, but I do know that we need that political movement. We need that resistance movement, and we need everybody to bring whatever talents they have to bear on the situation while there's still life on our planet.
Well, you write about the distinction between liberals and radicals. I mean, you know, you listen to Fox News. I mean, I don't know anybody who really does, but, you know, they're always demonizing liberals as if they're, you know, the most horrible thing on the planet. And I think they consider liberals radicals, but I don't think you probably do.
No, and I'm talking about just sort of the classic political philosophy, you know, the cardinal differences between the liberal viewpoint and the radical take on the world. So I'd say there's two main differences. So for liberals, society is made up of individuals. And in fact, the individualism is so sacrosanct that for them, being identified as a member of a group or a class of people, that's considered an insult, because everybody is this sacrosanct individual. Now, on the radical side, it's a very different view. Society for radicals is always made up of classes of people. And Karl Marx was the person who figured this out. And this is a debt that I think we all owe to Marx, whether we want to be Marxist or not. He was the one that saw that society is actually made up of classes. It's not made up of just random individuals. There's a class of people who have power, and those are the people who own the wealth. And then there were the people who, you know, had to do all the labor and sell their labor because they didn't have a choice, and that was the working class, the proletariat. You can extend that analysis, you know, to pretty much any system of oppression that you want to look at. So there's groups of people, and there's some that have power and some that don't. And so in this view, being identified as a member of that group is not any kind of an insult or an affront to people. It's actually, you know, that first step for political consciousness is realizing this is not happening to me as an individual. This is happening to me because I'm a woman, or I'm a poor person, or I'm a person of color, or whoever it is that you are. It's not because of who you are as a person, as you as an individual. It's not about your individual hopes or dreams or talents or failings. It's because you're a member of a group. And so ultimately, effective action comes from making common cause with people who share that condition. And then you hopefully have the power to overthrow that system. So that's one big division. Is society made up of individuals? And is that individual going to be so sacrosanct that you can't even think about your common condition? Or is society made up of groups of people, some of whom have power over others? And then the other big division. Oh, go ahead. You got a question?
Well, I was about to say, you know, one thing that has frustrated me for quite some time now is it doesn't seem like people with common cause will mobilize together. And I don't know what the problem is. I mean, maybe my understanding of this of all of this just isn't sophisticated enough. But can you give me any insight? I mean, for instance, I mean, what has happened to? I feel like the average person out there, I mean, millions and millions of people don't even know what's going on. The rest of them are so busy trying to pay the rent, they don't even care. And even so, they're so oppressed, they still seem to vote against their economic interest, and they aren't demanding change. And I guess I just don't understand that. I don't tend to be, you know, a passive person, and I don't understand this passiveness.
I don't either. And there may be people who can speak to that. I'm not sure that I'm one of them, because my whole life I've always seen, it was always clear to me that there was injustice and that my job was to do something about it. I mean, since I was 4 years old, I knew what I was here to do. And I would say most of my friends feel very similarly, that from a very young age, it was so clear that terrible things were going on and that our job, this was it. This was going to be the last moment, and we were going to have to try to change this. And so it's hard for me to talk to people who have never felt that kind of passion. I don't really understand them. They almost seem like a different species from me. The communication is really tough. And I love talking to people who came out of that background and now feel that passion, because I'm always curious, like, what was the epiphany? Where did it break for you? Like, what flooded into you that suddenly you saw it and you knew you had to do something? And I love those stories, because to me it means that transformation is possible. You know,
right.
that anybody really can come to life and decide, I'm going to stand up and be counted now because this matters. But I don't really understand the numbness and... So I think you're right.
Is it apathy, ignorance, fear? Or maybe it's all of those things.
Yeah, and I think in the rich countries, I hate to say it, but it's mixed with entitlement. That, you know, at the end of the day, people really like having their iPods and their computers and their cars and whatever amount of, you know, industrial consumer junk, you know, can be produced in China for cheap. They want it, and we get to have it because we live behind a military barricade, and they want to keep having it. So
we don't have it bad enough yet. You know?
Yeah, I think that there's more hope in other countries than there is here right now. This is in many ways the belly of the beast, and it's too good. You know, as long as the lights are on and the cupboards are full, people aren't going to feel it until they're not going to get motivated until it hurts their personal lives. And that's a very sad statement about, you know, at least one aspect of human nature, but I'm afraid it's true. So in some ways, my goal is to mobilize the people who feel the emergency, because those are people I can talk to. And I'm glad that there are people who can talk to the other kind, but I just don't know how. I mean, it hasn't been my experience in life, and I don't know how to reach through.
Well, no, I know what you mean. I mean, I have friends that still live in the South and still listen to Rush Limbaugh and Fox News, and
right.
It's like I don't even know what to say to them, you know? I mean, sincerely, I can't even really have a conversation with them unless maybe we're talking about the weather, because it's like they're in a totally different reality and they just as well be on another planet, and it feels like they aren't even worth the air they breathe. But, you know, maybe that's not a nice thing to say, but I'll say it. I did. So let's end the conversation on. Is there anything positive we can say? If any of my listeners out there feel like you and I do, and they've just been dying to join a group or contribute to a cause, or feel like they're doing something, you know, because they're waiting for the revolution in the street and it isn't coming yet, can you point them in a direction where maybe they can put their energy?
Well, we have an organization called Deep Green Resistance, named after the book. And, I think that we have a pretty good strategy about how we're going to try to get from here to there. And it does involve, you know, taking away the ability of the rich to steal from the poor and destroy the planet. And, you know, we got to say that out loud. They are destroying the planet. They're destroying human communities. They are destroying any chance we have for justice and sustainability. And they are going to have to be stopped. It's not a mistake. It's not a misunderstanding. They have the power. They know it. And we've got to take it away from them. And they've, you know, managed to take, I mean, there's, you know, that the great 99% versus the 1%. I mean, it was just, there's such a beautiful way to just put it in one sentence, the way that the Occupy movement has done. And it's true. And add to that that, you know, 99% of the prairies are gone and 98% of the old growth forests are gone, and you've got a pretty devastated situation. So, yeah, we need people who feel that fire to come forward and either join our group or join groups like it that are actually going to name, you know, the true depth of the horrors and the short time frame that we have left. We've really only got a generation or two before the planet may be unlivable, and we need to face how bad that is. But I don't think that this is hopeless. I think that we can reclaim our democracies, we can reclaim our communities, we can try to repair and restore the destroyed land bases that we see around us, and we can learn to live again as participants in those living communities. I think it's part of our biological makeup. You know, it's what we evolved out of, and I think we are all lonely inside to rejoin. We just don't know it.
Right. Well, and I hate to even ask you this because I worry about what your answer is, but I want you to be honest. You know, given the choice between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, I mean, or people like you siding with the Democrats, or are you with sort of that group that says they're both no good and, you know, we need to just totally start over?
You know, I don't tell other people what to do on voting day because it's a real flashpoint. You know, it brings out a lot of emotions in people because it's a very symbolic, you know, it's a highly symbolic act going to that voting booth. And I understand, I've got friends who refuse to vote in national elections because it just feels like such a sold-out process. I respect that. I really do. I actually don't take that position. And I tell you the reason why is because women died to get the vote.
Right.
And I can't forget what women were tortured, you know, with force feeding so that I could vote. And
right.
I know that that process has been made essentially useless at this point with the corporate control, you know, corporate personhood, and now the way they're allowed to just buy elections. I understand that this is a useless thing, but I also know what went into getting universal suffrage, you know, that people of color and white women, you know, went through and lost their lives, some of them, so that I could vote. So I can't let that go by on election day. I always remember it, you know, like what
right.
the price was
right.
that I can approach that voting booth. So I do it. But I don't enjoy what my choices are because they're pretty stupid. If there's a Green Party, I always vote for them just so that they can get a little more, you know, one more vote. But I think the really important thing here is that we got to think more strategically. Number one, the United States is way too big. Number two, it's already collapsing. Number three, we need to think bioregionally, and we especially need to think locally. And the right has been so good at this. The problem with the left is that, you know, we hate the government because of, you know, the kinds of power interest that it represents. And the right loves the government for the same reason. I mean, I know they make all these, you know, comments about big government and blah, 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 but in fact, they're very, very good at taking over government. You know, the Tea Party movement sprung up out of nowhere, and within 6 months, they were in the House and the Senate, you know,
right.
in Washington.
Right.
The left doesn't do that. All we do is withdraw in disgust and moral outrage, which are fine emotions to have, but it's not going to get us anywhere. So I think on a local level, anybody who has the stomach to do this, we need to be taking back our democracies on a local level and doing whatever we can to get money out of it, to put forward ideas about direct democracy rather than representational democracy. Look into town meeting in Vermont and the way that they run things in Vermont, town by town. It's a great model. Switzerland is also a great model. Sweden is a great model. There are way better functioning democracies than what we've got here. And in the end, it's all we're going to be left with, because the federal government, one way or another, empire collapses. That is just a historic fact. This one will be no different. That federal government is going to, in one way or another, it will fall apart, you know, over the next 100 years. And the question is, what's going to be left? So are we going to be engaged enough in our local communities that we let civic order hold, that we uphold human rights, and that we try to make sure everybody is fed and cared for? And if we can put forward those basic human and feminist values and try to actualize those on a local level, we'll be in a much better position to do the kind of restoration work both to democracy and to our land that need to happen. But, yeah, so I think that on a local level, that's really the place that we've got to get started.
Okay. Well, on that note, on somewhat of a positive note, I want to thank you for being out there in the world. I mean, we really need so many more of you. Can you manage to clone yourself?
Well, Karen, I can say the same thing, that the work that you're doing is really important. And I have a concept that I like to talk about, a culture of resistance, because it's only when you have a culture of resistance that you can get a resistance movement. That is the cradle of the resistance movement. And the work that you're doing is creating that culture of resistance. You're giving us symbols and myths and stories and encouragement and inspiration. And people aren't going to resist without that as their backdrop. So you're doing something that's incredibly important.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and I just hope there's enough people out there listening. I mean, I don't mean to my show, but I mean to these new ideas, because obviously we need some radical change, and you know, people have to move forward fearlessly instead of, you know, being like a deer in the headlights and you know, just continuing the, you know, being handmaidens of the patriarchy, handmaidens of the status quo, you know, continuing to just do things that are against their economic interests. It's really insane when you think about it. You know, I grew up all my life thinking human beings were much smarter, and it feels like the older I get, I lose more and more hope, you know, because I start to see, wow, you know, it feels like the majority of people are just a bunch of sheeple, and that disturbs me. It disturbs me greatly, and I don't know. I'm sure you probably thought the same way.
No, it's really hard, because I don't want to walk around feeling contempt. I just don't. It's an ugly way to feel. But it's really hard to, like, generate compassion when the world is being killed because of their stupidity. You know,
yeah, I mean, look, I had a girlfriend who I knew all my life, and I love her dearly, and I said to her once, well, are you following the politics? Do you know what Republicans have done across the country, and, you know, about contraception and abortion? Right. And she said, I'm 50 years old. Why should I care? You know, and I wanted to, like, just fall off my chair. I went, do I even know you? You know?
Right.
Anyway, well, Lear, thank you so much, and please feel free, if you ever have anything else you want to come back on the show and discuss. The door is always open, and if you ever want to pop me an email and make sure I know something's going on, please do. Let's keep in touch.
Okay, thank you so much, Karen.
All right. So, listeners, we have been listening. Our second guest is Lear Keith, the author of two important books, The Vegetarian Myth, Food Justice and Sustainability, and Deep Green Resistance, Strategy to Save the Planet. I would really recommend that you maybe play the show over again, because both Joan and Lear have been talking about some very important concepts, some deep concepts, and we really only scratched the surface, and they really are subjects that need to be understood, whether we're talking about our food source or we're talking about our myths, because our myths inform our society. You know, it's just all pieces of the puzzle. So before we go tonight, I'd like to give you a sneak peek of what's coming up on Voices of the Sacred Feminine in the next couple weeks, because we only have about 2 minutes before we go off the air. Next week, we have Rachel Larris from the Women's Media Center discussing sexism in the media, followed by Michael Weber from the Farm Animal Rights Movement, who's working to end the use of animals for food. The following week, Carolyn Shearer, she'll be with us. She's the founder of Absolute Love Publishing. She's going to chat about women saving the world, and scholar Rosemary Radford Ruther on ecofeminism. So, in closing, listeners, I hope you have a wonderful week, and as the Goddess Temple of Orange County prays, Great Queen of Heaven and Earth, all life flows from you. Our gratitude is eternal. So with that, I will close with a little bit of music here to maybe give us something to feel good about. Let's play Arms of the Mother by Abigail Spinner McBride. Good night, listeners. Until next week.